Hello and welcome once again to the Many Rules of Film Club. This is Jeff Yance. I am the program director at the Loft Cinema. And once again, we are joined by the occasional filmmaker, Heather Laris.
Hello.
And the multimedia artist, Rusty Boulay Stevenson.
Never been falsely accused of one murder. That's true.
Yeah. Yet. Yeah,
exactly. Got a long life still ahead of me.
I think we all have that opportunity today. Today we're talking about documentaries, I think a topic that is near and dear to all of our hearts. And particularly, we want to talk about the Sight and Sound list of best documentaries of all time. We've also discussed the Sight and Sound list of best narrative films of all time, so it only seemed fair to look at their documentary picks. So I have the list here of the top 10, so I just wanted to read these off. And so we can agree, disagree, be contentious, be supportive, and discuss. So the number one film documentary, according to Sight and Sound, is Man with the Movie Camera by Bertov. Number two film is Sans Soleil by Chris Marker, the experimental film. Number three, Thin Blue Line by Errol Morris. Number four, Shoah by Claude Lanzmann. Number five, Night and Fog by Alain René. Number six, Salesman by Albert and David Maisels. Number seven, The Titicut Follies by Frederick Wiseman. Don't Look Back by D.A. Pennebaker, which is the Bob Dylan documentary. And then there was a tie for the next position, number nine, two Robert Flaherty films of Man of Iran and Nanook of the North. And then the number 10, Grey Gardens by Albert and David Maisels. And this is, I think, a 35 title list. There are others on here as well. Just a couple were Hoop Dreams, Burden of Dreams, Grizzly Man, Roger and Me, Harlan County, USA, the ever and always controversial Triumph of the Will by Leni Riefenstahl, and Kyanna Scotsi by Godfrey Reggio, which is an amazing experimental documentary as well.
The Up series is on there as well.
Up series, yes, fantastic also. So Heather and Rusty, what do we think about this list? I guess, what do we think about Man with a Movie Camera at number one?
I'm an editor at heart, so I love Man with a Movie Camera. If I was teaching an editing class, I would that'd be one of the first movies I would have my students watch, just because it laid the foundation for taking visual images, cutting them together to make some sense. The ultimate experiment. Here he has this new camera. Let's go around and edit it together. I mean, there's definitely some foundation to it. And it's just a good lesson. I mean, I don't know why. I just love watching it. It's such a great, structurally, it's so great.
I agree. Film grammar. I think if you're interested in learning film grammar, that's the film to start with. And it's great because watching that also with a live score, and if you've ever had the great opportunity to see that with a live score, but it really lends itself to that because it's pure visual cinema. So you don't have to worry about narrative.
Yeah. That's the first thing I ever learned was how can you tell a story without a soundtrack, a verbal soundtrack? So without narration or an interview, how can you tell that story visually, just visually?
Yeah.
And Man with the Movie Camera is the best example of that.
Agreed.
Yeah, if we were teaching a documentary class, Man with the Movie Camera is number one. I tend to agree. Unlike the Sight and Sound list of the best films, I agree with the number one pick here as Man with a Movie Camera. And I think Salesman is almost 1B for me, as far as like the most important documentaries, the ones that everybody should see if you want to know documentary film. Historically, they're super important. It's hard to really argue with it, honestly, I think.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's an amazing film. And when you look at the list, we had talked about trying to get inside the heads of the voters to see what films ended up on the list and what their criteria was. I don't really know what their criteria is, but I think the films they select are really probably selected on historical significance, influence, and impact, perhaps.
Yeah.
Like the ones that started that genre in documentary, I kind of think are represented in the top 10, like the Sans Soleil, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. Sans Soleil is like the groundbreaking experimental documentary. and not everyone can watch it, but it's such a great thing. And Salesman, one of the first to show day in the life of a salesman, and in such a way that there was not really a narrator. It was just goes along with him, and it is observational.
Yeah, and that and I think that was one of the first direct cinema films. Showa is also amazing. It's a difficult film to watch. It's many hours long.
Like 9 hours, right?
Yeah, 9 hours, I think. Nine or ten.
That one.
Yeah, but it is amazing, and it is a real commitment, mm-hmm. for sure. But in terms of long form documentary storytelling, it's incredible. It's and one of the first and probably one of the best.
And, well, and it's still carried on. I mean, Netflix has Making of a Murderer, which we'll talk about again, but that's a 9 hour piece.
Yeah,
and that people sat and watched.
Yeah, I think today with binge watching and Netflix, I think we're more familiar with the long term documentary format.
Yeah.
So I think that's an example of the influence of
that's
a movie
true.
Like
that's
Showa,
true.
Like where we're at today. It just took a while, you know, to catch up.
Yeah, a different format. Being able to watch it
right.
at home,
right.
on your own time.
You don't have correct. To take a break at the movie theater in between right. 9 hours.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and another interesting one on the list, I think, is Nanook of the North. I know we had talked about this earlier. Very controversial film in the history of documentary filmmaking because the bulk of it was staged. It's about an Inuit tribe made by Robert Flaherty in 1922. Purporting to be an ethnographic study of this Inuit tribe, but it was revealed later that most of the situations were scripted and staged.
Nanook wasn't even his real name.
Not even his real name.
Not telling the story of real Inuits. It's telling the story of what a white person's idea of what the Inuit culture should have looked like in 1920s. You know, so it's
very problematic in terms of identity politics and also about truth in documentary filmmaking.
Yes.
By this point, the tribe had firearms, which the movie does not show.
No, it very much exoticizes them as being primitive.
Treats them as objects, not as people.
And they weren't necessarily at that point. But an interesting film, and I think maybe we disagree on this, but I can see why it's on the Sight and Sound list because it was the first. It's a great tool to discuss a lot of issues about the truth in documentary filmmaking and intentionality of filmmakers and what kind of privilege you have to tell another culture's story. The idea of being upfront with an audience about how much is staged and how much is real.
Yeah.
Right.
It really opens up a lot of discussions. I mean, as a film, it's troubling for sure.
If it's framed that way, I think if you're, you know, you're doing a film 101 class and you frame it that way, I think that's great. When I experienced it, it was not framed that way. It was like Nanook of the North broke ground for cultural ethnographic documentaries. Right. And at that point, and maybe that was just lack of knowledge, but at that point they hadn't exposed the fact that most of it had been staged and that, you know, and I think that was not part of our conversation of what lens are you looking at that through instead of, you know, that kind of thing. So I think if you frame it that way, yes, I think it's, and I definitely think it has a place on the list with that caveat.
And then that's our recurring theme of media literacy, like the importance of people being aware, media literate, critical viewers.
That's right.
And knowing what you're getting into and researching and finding out what's really happening in the film.
And what a documentary is. A documentary is not just news journalism necessarily at all. It's somebody who's got a point to make a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Roger and Me, Michael Moore's film about the auto industry in Flint, Michigan, he had a point he was trying to make. He obviously left stuff out that did not make that point.
It is not objective in any way, shape, or form. But
no.
He doesn't purport it to be.
Right. He doesn't claim it.
It's not journalism.
Right.
No.
No. It's like a personal essay, basically, but also very entertaining. I mean, I think he understood the importance of entertaining an audience while also giving them your point of view.
Well, I mean, a film, especially in this day and age, even when Roger and Me was made, needed to make money.
Mm, that's
that's really the point of a film mostly at this point. I mean, artists want to make things, and that's what artists do. But ultimately, if a film is going to get made and shown in theaters, it's because it's going to make money.
Right.
Hopefully.
And, yeah, and as a filmmaker, you want people to see your film.
Right.
So you have to be thinking about the audience. You can't just be...
And how to entertain them.
Exactly. Just one other one I wanted to discuss on this list, because it is an eternally controversial film, is Triumph of the Will, the Leni Riefenstahl film from 1935, which even mentioning the title to people riles them, to be honest. It is, you know, it's a Hitler propaganda film for the Third Reich. And she was commissioned by the Hitler regime to make this film. And she was an incredible filmmaker. And she made a beautiful film that's also a troubling film. And this is also one of those films where you need context to know why she was making it. She's always been very cagey about what her intentions with the film were and what her association was with the Nazi Party. But what do we think about that? Is it still a valid documentary, even though it's questionable subject matter and questionable intentionality?
I liken it to putting Birth of a Nation on a greatest films list. Mm. They're both really problematic. But again, media literacy comes up. If you understand what it is you're looking at and you take it into the context, it's important. I think it's important. I think if I were doing the Sight and Sound list and I had to give my top 10 documentaries, I probably wouldn't put it in my top 10, but I'd be more likely to put that in my top 10 than Nanook of the North, for me personally.
Mm, right.
Because I think it's culturally important. I think it's something that we should really look at, in fact.
It's also a better film. I think just from a filmmaking standpoint, it's actually a beautiful film.
It is a beautiful. And the cinematography is... phenomenal.
And the editing is spot on, and its emotional impact is really great. And she did that through editing and sound and visuals, which is what you want from a good film.
Right.
But then the subject matter is just so disturbing.
What I think nowadays, I don't like that. People are afraid to show things that at one time was acceptable. Just frame it right. You know what I mean? Like, this is a good example of a propaganda film that you can use to analyze current propaganda of today.
Yes.
If you watch Triumph of the Will.
Right.
So I think we shouldn't shy away from that. We should not be afraid. So I think it's definitely worth mentioning and probably should be somewhere in the list.
Yeah. I think it's valid.
What about Killing of the Light? Is that the name of the film, Jeff? Have you seen that one? Where they reenacted all the killings.
The act of killing.
Yes. That was, that's kind of flipping it on its head. Like, instead of making a historical documentary, you're literally reenacting what happened.
Oh, Act of Killing is amazing. I think that was, to me, the last documentary that's really sort of changed the form and done something new with documentary, because it is reenacting real things that are happening, but it's being reenacted by the people who actually were involved with the murders.
Right.
That's pretty heinous.
It is, and it gets into a lot of questions of ethics on the part of the filmmakers and the participants who are doing this. Why are they doing this? Why are we watching it?
Yeah, why are we watching?
But that's what, to me, that's what a good movie is supposed to do. It's supposed to make you question all of those things.
And yes.
So, the idea that everything has to be good and right and happy and not questioning, right, is not a good trend.
No.
We should be questioning these things. We cannot just keep on accepting things.
Right. And interestingly, that filmmaker did a follow-up called The Look of Silence last year, which was told from the perspective of the victims. So I think it was sort of a call and response to the original film, because there was so much discussion about how dare you allow the murderers to tell their story in this film. And but it was an amazing bookend to the story, for sure. And you got the whole complete picture. It was almost like a Rashomon story, where you heard two different perspectives of the same incidents. And pretty amazing. But I totally agree. Like, people get very hung up on the idea, the subject matter of a film, and disregard it if it doesn't agree with their personal politics.
And it isn't easily classifiable.
Right.
we like to put things in categories, in nice, neat categories that all make sense. And it is easy for me to digest. And I know this is what it is. And that's that.
Yeah. And I always tell people when I talk to them at the movie theater, like, it's okay. It's great to see something you disagree with.
Yes.
Or that you don't like, because it really causes you to question, what do I need from a film? What's important to be in a film? And if you only see films you like, you don't get that experience. You don't question yourself at all.
Well, that's a really good point, Jeff.
Yeah. So, see films you disagree with.
I think it's good
and
practice.
And just see what happens.
And even if it makes you mad, you still watch them, because that's just good.
Because you're still feeling something.
Yes.
It's better than feeling nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that's something that you can think about for days on end. If it's something that you know, I agree with this entirely, there's little thought involved in that then.
Right. Who wants to live in a bubble like that all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have our favorite documentaries as well. And I think we each try to pick a film that was on the Sight and Sound list that we love, a documentary film. And Heather, you had talked about Harlan County, USA by Barbara Kopple.
Yes, one of, in my opinion, it's 24 on the Sight and Sound list, and it should be way higher than that, but that's just me. I will say that the first time I saw this was on VHS, and it did not do justice to it, and I had recently seen it on the Criterion Collection. It is beautiful. Anyone who likes cinematography, especially documentary cinematography, highly recommend Harlan County, USA. It's such great and beautiful 16 millimeter. It's beautiful. And anyways, I digress about the technical stuff. But I have made a few short documentaries myself, so Harlan County, USA is near and dear to my heart because it called into my soul. that part, I think, of a documentary's job is to speak for the people who don't have a voice.
Yes.
And Harlan County, USA does that in a very beautiful way. And it did it in a non-traditional way, in that there was no narrator. It just let the people of Harlan County, USA be themselves. And it's about a coal miner strike. And Barbara Kopple went into this community, originally started the film to deal with the union. She was more looking at it from the union perspective, like administration, the union, and the coal miners union. And then it just turned into, here's Harlan County on strike and how it affected their very small community, very poor community, and how they were fighting for worker safety, pay, you know, the right to strike. And she just kind of became part of the community. And with her and her small camera crew, it was her and like maybe two or three other people. And I was just so impressed. You know, it is a union film. It's definitely pro-union, but at the same time, it's critical of the union because it does show how there is politics in the union. Mm-hmm. And so it shows, you know, the people on the picket line. It shows the strong backbone of the women of the community who basically, you know, at one point there was, I think, some laws saying that some of the men couldn't do certain things, but there's nothing that said their wives and their mothers and their sisters couldn't. And so the women in that community got involved.
Yep.
And they kind of had their own organizing going. And that was very powerful. I mean, it was she started shooting 1971, 72, 73. So like feminist movement, that kind of thing, but in a community that you would not normally think that, you know. And so that was awesome, you know, to see that. And shows the violence behind a strike, you know, the company goons that are going to come and pressure you to not be on the picket line, to not fight for your rights. And all of that was very inspirational to me. And it's done with this, a lot of close-ups, a lot of medium shots, close-up shots. And she also, if you watch the making of Harlan County, USA, which is on the Criterion DVD, they talk about her using a wireless mic, which was not very frequent back then. And so she would use a wireless mic so she could get conversations. And there's this one scene where they go to New York and they're picketing the coal company there. And one of the guys has a sandwich board on, you know, and he's talking to one of the police officers, and they're talking about how it's fair and what's fair wages and what you should be making. And it's a very intimate conversation that you would have never gotten had you not had a wireless mic at that time. And that's just technology that was not very frequent. So to me, that was very special. She was able to capture things that they hadn't done before in terms of the labor movement and the labor movement versus big companies. And so then on the other hand, they had a lot of footage. They did go and get some footage, not from that Harlan County coal mine, but from another coal mine. So you get the idea of how dirty and hard work, like the hard work that it is to be in that coal mine, you know, and the men and women who got black lung from the coal mine, and or they got injured because the roof would fall in on them. And so all of that happens. And this version, she won the 1976 Academy Award for it. So it was had lots of accolades. So being at 24 shocked me.
Yeah. She's an amazing filmmaker, though. And I almost liken her to, I think I mentioned earlier, like Jane Goodall, like going into another culture, into another environment. And she immersed herself.
Right.
She got to know all these people before she started filming them. She lived there in that town.
Yeah. She became part of their community. And so I think there's a little difference. Not nowadays, it seems to be like just a slice, but she really got in there. She's, she was lifelong friends with a lot of those women, especially because she developed such great bonds with them. I mean, there's a point where she's shot at that, you know, the company goons attack them. Like, she was getting kicked and thrown on the ground.
And that's in the film.
Yeah, and that's in the
amazing.
Film.
And see her being shot at.
Yeah. And so I think it took such dedication to do this. And I think she just had the no fear of being early 20s. In her early 20s and wanting to be a filmmaker, that's what kept her going. Like, you get that feeling from the movie that's what kept her going, like knowing that this is what she was doing, something right. You see, you know, many of the old coal miners have breathing issues. So, you know, one ended up in she didn't catch this on film, but one of the coal miners who was picketing got shot at and was murdered. So it was such a groundbreaking to show a union situation like that. I don't think the country had ever seen a union situation like that, to see the big company and then the inner workings of the union. And I think that's why it was so groundbreaking as well. You know, it's near and dear to my heart, and I highly recommend it. I will say though, it is hard to find, and the only copy I could find in Tucson was at the public library.
Yay for library.
Yes, yay for public library. So always remember, you can always go pick up a DVD at your library. The local video store only has one copy, and it's not surprisingly on any streaming service that I could get a hold of. So anyways, it's underrated. You should see it.
Great film.
It's a great film. It's worth a watch. And it has such strong characters that you wanted to know what happened to them afterwards. So it's nice to see the making of Harlan County that they made later, that you got to see a couple of the people that were in the movie still nowadays, where they're at and what they're doing. And, you know, it's still a struggle. And Barbara Koppel went on to make many pieces later. She did one other labor one that was about Hormel and the labor situation there, called American Dream. Mm-hmm. She's done a lot of informational documentaries. She did the recent
Sharon Jones.
Yeah, that one.
And she did Shut Up and Sing, the Dixie Chicks
movie,
really interesting during their
Bush
battle
era
with George Bush.
And so she's great. She has some documentaries under her belt. You should check them out, and especially Harlan County, USA.
Yeah, and her being on this list is important. There's not a lot of women filmmakers on this list.
No.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, there are two. It's Barbara Koppel and Leni Riefenstahl, which is...
There you have it.
Not great. I mean, I think more women have made documentaries than those two.
Yes.
When Harlan County also is part of a longer tradition, I almost liken it to Sinclair Lewis and the Jungle, where she was really trying to show us behind the scenes of this industry that affects all Americans.
Right.
And she's trying to shine a light on that. And I think that's a really important point. What you were saying is a lot of times great documentaries, that's what they do, is they shine a light on something we're not always thinking about in the front of our minds.
Yeah, and giving a voice to those who don't have a voice, which is really important. And that movie in particular, those people did not have
the
voice of the media. They didn't have media attention on them.
And especially the wives I mean, come on. They were, right. You know, they were saying like, oh, some of the husbands were put off because they're used to coming home to their wives cooking the hot meal and, you know, doing their clothes. And here these women are, you know, up at 4 a.m. on the picket line helping their husbands out. And that's such an important thing to show.
And I feel like Barbara Kopple's female perspective helped draw that out.
Oh,
I don't know if a male filmmaker would have necessarily... He would have seen the story.
And I don't think a male filmmaker would have gotten at the access that she got.
Right.
You know, like when she confronts some of the goons from the company that like shot at them, I don't think she would have even gotten that far with them had she not been a woman. So
right.
There's something to it when you're a female documentarian. So.
So maybe sort of playing off of that, the film that I love that's on this list is Grey Gardens, the Albert and David Maisel's film. From 1975. And the connection is that Barbara Kopple got her start working for Albert and David Maisel's I think she was in college at the time, and it was an assistant camera person on Gimme Shelter, the Rolling Stones documentary that the Maisels made, where she was charged with guarding the camera equipment at Altamont with the Hells Angels running riot and crazed fans Gotta start somewhere. So I think that made her unafraid to do what she did in Harlan County. I think, you know, gave her the bravery. So Grey Gardens is one of my favorite documentaries. I just think it's amazing. Look at two women. It's also direct cinema. Albert and David Maisels were really the ones that kind of pioneered that whole movement. Basically just watching something unfold, fly on the wall technique without inserting yourself into the film, although they did that occasionally. And it's just this interesting look at these two women, relatives of Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, living on Long Island in this decaying southern, it looks like a southern gothic mansion out of a Tennessee Williams film or
yes.
play. The whole thing has a real vibe of Tennessee mm-hmm. Williams for sure.
Real dysfunction.
Yeah, but it's Big Edie, a 70-something-year-old woman, and her daughter, Little Edie.
Who's in her 50s in
the
movie.
Who's in her 50s, so not really little at that point. But living in total isolation in this decaying mansion, which is overrun with raccoons and cats, and there's no running water. There's kind of piles of garbage everywhere. They were sort of a embarrassment to the Bouvier family, so they were sort of shunned off to the side. And then when it came to pass, there was an article about them in New York Magazine, which brought them to the attention of David and Albert Maisel, said, "Ah, this is going to make a great story." And so they went, met these two women, and just kind of filmed them over the course of several months, got to know them first, and then started filming them. And if you've seen the film, you know that Big Edie and Little Edie are two very eccentric women, I think would be putting it mildly, who have created their own kind of society, isolated from anyone else. Some people have claimed they think they were mentally ill. I think there's the jury's out on that. They certainly lived a different lifestyle than most people, but does that automatically make you crazy? I don't know. Mm. And there have been accusations of exploitation on the part of the filmmakers for filming these two women. But for me personally, I think they come off great, and there's a certain amount of affection in the film towards these two women. I think Albert and David Maisels really liked them, and I think the two women really enjoyed the attention, particularly Little Edie, who is
an
amazing big old piece of ham, mm-hmm. and she loved it, and she harbored dreams of being a performer, and that's part of the poignancy, is that she never got to realize those dreams because she had to help her mother, who was ill, and she had to stay at the mansion with her. So being in this film gave her the opportunity. There's an amazing scene where she does this weird kind of marching dance routine.
Oh, God, yes. I've seen that. I've watched it a few times.
Waving an American flag.
Kind of painful.
Kind of painful, and then, you know, kind of amazing because she's totally unselfconscious.
Right. Yeah.
Which, to me, is kind of inspiring. Like, oh, we should all be like that. We should all just dance.
That's true. That's a good point.
You know?
Wave our freak flags.
Wave it high.
Yeah. You know.
And, you know, she's wearing... Also, the movie kind of became famous as a kind of a style guide of sorts, a fashion guide. Little Edie loves wearing whatever's handy. A tablecloth, a bra as a hat.
Anything as a hat.
anything is a hat. And she has a very famous line in the film. I love the fact that this is a documentary that created famous lines. But she says at one point, I think this is the best costume for today.
Yes.
When they're asking her, oh, what are you wearing? And she's wearing literally a tablecloth wrapped around her body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a dish towel around her head. She said, I think this is the best costume for today.
That's great.
Yeah. And so this movie really kind of jumped out of the doc. I think it's the only documentary I can think of that sort of jumped out of the documentary world and became sort of a cultural artifact that influenced fashion and created a Broadway musical based on this. And then a feature film on HBO, a narrative film with Jessica Lange and Drew Barrymore. So it's kind of created a whole industry, a Grey Gardens industry. But again, I think its importance is that whole idea of subject matter and filmmaker and how close do you get to the people you're filming? And where do you draw the line between showing too much and pulling back?
Sure. Well, little Edie doesn't do a lot of the stuff that she does if there's not a camera around.
Right.
She wants to put on a show.
She wants to put on a show. She knows she's got an audience of the Maisels and this camera and that they're going to show it to other people. So she goes out of her way to do things she would not ordinarily do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's once something's observed, it's observed, and so it's going to act differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's the observer effect, the science term. Yes.
Yeah.
And I never, it made me feel uncomfortable at certain times for personal reasons, but not because I necessarily thought they were making a fool of her. I don't necessarily think that.
Let me ask, Jeff, you've shown it at the Loft. Do people laugh at these ladies or do they laugh with them?
It's very difficult to discern laughter.
It is. I mean,
You can hear laughter, but do you know why they're laughing? This is the tricky thing about Grey Gardens, I think, is that particularly little Edie is performing and she wants to be a performer. And she had performed prior to this. And she actually had a cabaret show after the movie when she became
so awesome.
Famous again. Yeah. So she obviously knew how to work an audience.
Right.
And so she's saying things in the film that are clearly intentionally funny.
Yeah.
And people laugh at that and they respond, I think, in the way she would have wanted them to. I think some people probably do laugh at the eccentricities of the two of them, especially when they're fighting with each other.
I think I've laughed at them when I've watched it.
Which makes it sort of an uncomfortable, interesting experience watching because you question why you are reacting at all to this film, which I think good filmmaking does.
It
causes you to question yourself.
But I don't think the Maisels were being mean, I would say. Ultimately, I've thought about this so much and I've had so many conversations about it. But the Maisels, I think, really cared about both Edies.
Yes. And Albert Maisels said he loved them and thought they were great. At first, they thought they were great characters. And then they found them to be really great people once they got to know them. But I think that's the trick is as a documentary filmmaker, you're drawn to a good story first and foremost. And then do you make that leap into sort of understanding that there are human lives involved in the story you're telling? And do you like them as people? And I think that really comes through in this. It's not cruel. Mm-hmm. It's not mocking. I just think they're eccentric people whom you would probably laugh at in real life if you saw them out on the street wearing a tablecloth and a dish rag on their head.
Yeah.
You would probably do a double take and look. But that's human nature. I think it's sort of getting at a very deep part of human nature in that you look at something that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you have an uncomfortable reaction. Do you laugh?
Right.
Do you feel sympathy? But I don't think either one of these characters is looking for sympathy in the film, which is interesting.
I agree.
No, I don't think they are. I don't think they are. And I think they knew what they were doing. I don't think they were clearly, if they were mentally ill, they're not so mentally ill that they don't know what's happening. They clearly know what the reality of the situation is.
Yeah.
I think clearly.
Yeah. And they both went to see the premiere at Lincoln Center when the film premiered and they both understood and enjoyed the adulation they received for it. Mm-hmm. They knew what they were doing when they signed on to the project, I think, which I think is important. It wasn't like they were ambushing them.
the Maisels could have been meaner. I mean, they could have shown stuff that was a lot harder. There's a there's a moment where Big Edie kind of falls out of her dress a little bit and the camera looks away. They're
respectfully,
not respectfully looks away. And so they're not trying to be mean to these people at all. I think that's clear. It's tough. It's a tough movie. And now there's a short parody of Grey Gardens that totally makes fun of Grey Gardens.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's easy because I think it's also been appropriated as a camp film.
Yeah.
I mean, you can certainly see it. Even we had talked recently about John Waters.
Right.
These two women are characters out of a John Waters movie. Like if he had written a mother and daughter living together in a decaying mansion, it'd probably be these two.
With this weird sense of propriety.
Right, exactly. Because they come from money, so they still have this, they come from high society.
Yeah.
And they've fallen into squalor, so they still, but they still have the kind of propriety of high society. Mm-hmm. While they have raccoons running through their living room, which is this great dichotomy. So many cats. Yeah. So I think you can react to this film in many different ways, which I think is one reason it's become a cult movie, because it remains interesting because you never quite know how you should react to it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's fair. It's fair. I've been all over the map on this when I've watched it a few times and I've talked about it, especially to my wife who can't stand it.
Why does she say she can't stand it?
I don't know exactly, but I tease her a lot and say we should have a big and little Edie party and dress as your favorite Edie. we'll invite our friends over.
What are you waiting for?
Yeah. What are we waiting for?
Yeah. I mean, we've done Grey Gardens costume contests
at
the Loft, and it's great because people really get into it. And
most people dress as little Edie, I'm guessing.
I think Big Edie's a little harder to pull off.
Yeah.
Although there were a certain number of floppy hats and loose-fitting bathing suits,
okay,
I will say.
Yeah.
Not to get into too much detail, but so I think it's taken on its own life now, even beyond the original.
It definitely has.
Yeah.
It definitely has.
Yeah. So interesting, I think, to be on the list for that reason alone, just that it sort of created a whole industry around itself and kind of leapt out of the documentary field.
And the Maisels are incredibly important filmmakers.
They are. They were ground zero for that whole movement, the direct cinema movement.
And yeah.
Gave a lot of other filmmakers their start, including Barbara Koppel and many others. And Albert Maisels recently passed away, unfortunately. So no more films from the Maisel brothers. Mm-hmm. David passed away in the 80s. So definitely one of my favorite, that along with Salesman, one of my favorite Maisels films. Yeah. And then, so the most recent film of our on the list that's a favorite of ours is Thin Blue Line from the 80s, and that Rusty, one of your faves.
Well, yeah, I love Errol Morris. I love all things Errol Morris. I'd watch Errol Morris eat a shoe.
Which has been done.
Which has been done. So I would do that, and I would watch most of his films. I probably don't think Thin Blue Line is his best, but I think historically it's his most important right now.
Yes.
It's about a man who was wrongfully convicted of murder, Randall Adams. And he talks to Errol Morris while he's behind prison bars. And the documentary reenacts a lot of what happens in the case and kind of illustrates how he couldn't have done it. Mr. Adams could not have done it. And in fact, in a conversation, Errol Morris gets another man to essentially confess. He says, well, there you have it. You know, yes, that's probably what happened, just what you're talking about. And Mr. Adams is somebody who doesn't ever, when you see him on screen, he never seems like somebody who could kill someone. Right. He was just a drifter in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's happened a lot where people in the wrong place at the wrong time, drifters have been accused of things wrongfully.
Yes.
It's part of a longer history in America that dates back even before Perry Mason. But Perry Mason was a TV show where the lawyer always was fighting to get these people off of murder charges who were wrongfully accused. And Americans eat that up. We love it. And so Thin Blue Line, in addition to doing these reenactments, which was rather groundbreaking for the time, and has since caught on. Obviously, it's been used over and over and over again, and now it's no longer controversial. Errol Morris, people didn't like the film because of the reenactments. That's not a documentary. That you're reenacting these things. So that it showed that documentaries have scripts, which a lot of people don't realize, that people write these things out ahead of time and plan how a movie will unfold. And so Errol Morris in that way was really groundbreaking. It also uses some really artsy shots that Errol Morris, and some really neat music that Errol Morris would become famous for in his films.
Philip Glass music.
Yeah, the Philip Glass music. And it's really thoughtful and really artsy. A lot of times the camera will just focus on the spinning light of a police car to let things sink in. That you've just heard and to make you think a little bit more without moving on to the next scene right away. And I think that that's really brilliantly done here. It's got problems, probably the same problems that led the man to be incarcerated. Errol Morris is sure that this guy's, I think his point of view is he's sure that he didn't do it from the get-go. And that's what he presents. He's a little more honest than I think the filmmakers in Making a Murderer, which is the recent Netflix 9-part series about Stephen Avery and his nephew who were convicted of a murder of a young woman. Mm. We know the nephew now has been exonerated, and obviously the Making of a Murderer movie shows you he didn't do it. It conveniently leaves out stuff about Stephen Avery, the film does, and the filmmakers did. And that's, to me, I always felt like as I was watching it, that it went beyond what Errol Morris did. And it purposefully was absolutely trying to convince you, A, the police are corrupt. B, Stephen Avery didn't do it and was framed. And I believed that. I believe that he was framed. I still think he probably committed that murder of the young woman. But I know that his nephew didn't. I feel certain of that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that those filmmakers were necessarily honest. That doesn't make it not a documentary. It's still a documentary. They're presenting a point of view. That's what a documentary does.
It's not journalism.
It's not journalism. So it's still a documentary. Mm-hmm. But this is where I feel like when I talk to people about Making a Murderer after the fact, so many people were just so upset with the system and the corrupt nature of the system that Stephen Avery had to be innocent. And I'm
That's
not convinced
true.
Of that.
That's
I'm
true.
I'm not convinced of that. And that, again, leads to a point where we're not media literate. If we see it on TV, like you were saying, Heather, there are people now who've seen that movie. They're staking everything they have on getting Stephen Avery out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a hard thing for me to know. And I'll just share real quickly because I think it's important. And I think it's part of what the Thin Blue Line did is really showing these people who've been wrongfully accused. My mother, her best friend when I was a very small child, when I was one, her best friend was murdered along with their child. They were kidnapped and murdered after days of being kind of tortured. The men went to prison. They were convicted and went to prison. One man, after 20 years in prison, started recanting a lot of stuff. Even though he was obviously there, he said, "But I never had a gun," despite his testimony otherwise. You know, the original prosecutor is gone, is dead at this point. The guy's coming up for parole. My mom would go and say, "Look, I'm glad that the man got an education. He found religion. He got married." That he had a documentary film crew following him. And my mother was fairly certain that that influenced the parole board, that here this group is making a film. They can't quite be completely wrong. Mm. We're not saying he wasn't involved, but he's now spent 20 years. My mother felt he should spend his life in prison. They tortured a little boy. They murdered her friend. She would go to parole hearings for all those 20 years, she went to parole hearings. And so it's interesting when you have these documentary filmmakers. I'm against the death penalty. I don't believe he should have been put to death. That's just how I am. If we were reforming people, I'd be open to that. Our prison systems don't do that, really, not very well. And when you have a documentary film crew, what happens is you've got somebody being observed. You've got the prison system now being observed. And so things change then. The man was paroled in after 24 years in prison, and he's out now. My mom originally worried for her life, since she had testified against him for years and years and years, and he knew about it. And, you know, it's something that's been under her skin, certainly, and has profoundly affected her life. And I think that it's something that documentary filmmakers, do they owe it to the public to try to show a balanced story? Do they owe it to try to be as unobtrusive as possible? No. I don't think they do. No. I don't think they do. I'm with you, Heather.
No. I don't think that's their job.
I don't think that's their job. It's their job to tell the story that they want to tell, whether you like it or not. That's not their problem.
That's right.
And I do think, like, historically, documentaries have, I mean, Harlan County, USA, the union has said that they didn't think that with the combination of factors, the camera crew being there helped them get a union contract, because the union and the company wanted to be seen certain ways. So cameras affect things whether you like it or not.
Yes.
And I think filmmakers should take that into consideration when they're deciding. I mean, I've had been struggling to figure out if I'm going to do another documentary myself. And one of them was about, actually, one of the gentlemen who was on death row in Arizona accused of setting the fire at the Pioneer Hotel. And I had thought about doing a documentary on him. But honestly, in my mind, I was like, am I responsible for him to try to get him out of prison? Mm. And so you kind of think that, and I don't know, I think most documentaries that would cross their mind, you know, what that is, but not necessarily to change their story, but what's their responsibility? It's a good thing. It goes along hand in hand with the good media criticism, being able to kind of separate things, you know,
right,
talking about making a murderer. I did not know certain details till after I watched it. And I went online and read a couple more articles. I didn't know some of the evidence that they didn't share in the documentary on Netflix that made me think, oh, wow, Stephen Avery probably did kill her. But in addition, the cops probably are corrupt and planted evidence. So I do agree that some things are heavy-handed, but that goes hand in hand with being a good critic and looking at what you're watching and saying, oh, I'm going to get online and go on social media and talk about my opinion, but did I even do any little research to figure out what's what?
And we have much more access now than, you know, contrasting with the days of Errol Morris when he made Thin Blue Line, the public didn't necessarily have access to that information.
That's right.
So that was their source of information about that case. Now we have access to pretty much anything we want.
Right. I mean, I read some of the court documents from Making of a Murderer, because honestly, I wanted to read some of the interviews just because I really wanted to know about the nephew, and I did it in a click, you know? So, and that, I think there's no excuse now. You just have to be, put it in your mind, like, don't believe everything you read or see.
So I got to ask you, you're talking about Louis Taylor.
Yes.
Did you end up talking to Louis Taylor? He's free now.
Yes, he is free now. I did not speak to him. I was like too overwhelmed with the idea. Honestly, I still think it's a great documentary idea. But just based on the court documents, the original court documents that I did read, it was ridiculous that he got convicted.
Yeah.
But I felt too overwhelmed by it. And so I didn't pursue it any farther than reading those court documents.
He was another man, just wrong place, wrong time. People didn't know who he was.
He was guilty of being black and being at the wrong place.
And he was a minority. And so they convicted him real quick.
It was a shame. And they owe him so much, and he's not going to get any of that back. But so I felt like I couldn't handle that. I mean, I know that some documentarians have been talking to him, so I'm hoping they'll do his story justice, but I'm not sure.
Right. And you're right, there would be expectations on you as a filmmaker to tell the quote unquote real story.
Right.
You're not trained as a journalist. Mm. And I almost feel like documentaries, maybe that would help people if there were disclaimers. We've never gotten to the point where we're putting disclaimers on documentaries for the most part.
Well, the question is, what kind of disclaimer? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I mean, they're kind of disclaimers on the Netflix one. They kind of give you a little bit of a background at the beginning, but I will say the most glaring thing is when you leave out evidence that blatantly says that person did it. That, I think, is probably the most problematic for me. But
I felt manipulated watching it.
And I think, like, you know, certain documentaries are definitely manipulative. You just have to know that. And you can get angry about it, and that's okay. It's a fine line. I have, you know, my thing for me is I want to tell their story, and I don't want to objectify them, and I don't want to manipulate them. I want them to tell most of their story as much as possible. But you can't get away from the fact that it's your voice because you're the director.
That's right.
So it's a struggle, but I think it's worth it. And I think documentaries change the world when, you know, it might take years down the road, but they do. So.
And I think that's the key, is being respectful to your subjects. Not being exploitive. You can tell your own perspective on the story, but you have to respect that they are people.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah, with lives. So this is a huge topic, obviously,
huge
that we
topic.
Could go on for days about, but I think we should probably wrap up now. But this was fascinating, and people should check out the Sight and Sound list. And
yes.
I mean, all of those movies are worth watching on one level or another.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, for sure.
Burden of Dreams, I recommend so highly. Burden of Dreams, about the making of Fitzcarraldo.
Yeah, by Les Blank. One of the best movies about a movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Hoop Dreams.
We're in agreement.
Hoop Dreams is great.
The Gleaners and I, which is another female director, which is, I highly recommend.
Yeah. Grizzly Man's on the list. An amazing Herzog film. And
Yeah.
Just check out that list. Sight and Sound, best documentaries of all time. Really great. So thank you, Heather, and thank you, Rusty. That was really interesting.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. And next time on Many Rules of Film Club, it's going to get real spooky here. It's going to get real scary because we're looking at the films of Stephen King, which brings me to rule number 666 of Many Rules of Film Club, which is, around Halloween, it's good to be the king if it's Stephen King. So we will see you then.
Well, and find us on the manyrulesoffilmclub.com.
Please do that and give us your suggestions for topics.
We're on Facebook.
iTunes. And turn around. We might be right behind you. Well, I'm gearing up for Halloween. I'm trying to be scary.
I agree with you.
Okay. All right. Thanks for listening.